This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 15, 2006. From the studios of KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. The Senate Committee on Homeland Security grills DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff for Hurricane Katrina response failures.
I think you've got a monumental disaster, and I think FEMA is the disaster.
And homeless organizers demonstrate to save the largest high-rise occupation in South America. All that plus news from New Orleans to South Africa and beyond after these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Australia's SBS television channel today broadcast graphic and disturbing footage of apparent abuse of Iraqi detainees by U.S. soldiers at the Abu Ghraib prison. The footage includes images that were reportedly viewed by U.S. lawmakers in 2004, but prevented from public release by a court battle. The Australian broadcaster says it is confident of the authenticity of the footage. This comes just days after the release of a video showing British soldiers beating boys thought to be civilians from southern Iraq. In Haiti, controversy surrounding last week's presidential election has escalated with the discovery of marked ballots in a state-run garbage dump. In the first days after the election, frontrunner René Préval had a strong lead with at least 60% of the vote. Préval and his supporters made allegations of fraud after his lead dipped to below the 50% plus one margin needed to avoid a runoff. Even the contested official vote count shows the second-place candidate trailing by 37%. The vote count has now stopped, and Haiti's interim government has promised an investigation into the fraud allegations. French President Jacques Chirac has ordered the aircraft carrier Clemenceau to return to France after a long campaign to stop it from being broken up in India. Environmental campaigners claim that the ship is lined with hundreds of tons of asbestos, which would endanger the lives of shipyard workers. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Chirac ordered the Clemenceau to return home just minutes after the country's highest court, the Council of State, suspended the ship's journey. It will be the end of a year and a half on the high seas, during which green campaigners have boarded the vessel and courts of law have wrangled over whether it can dock in the Indian port of Alang. Greenpeace representative Pascal Ufting says it's a victory for civil society and for Indian workers.
From now on, they can expect that the northern industrialized country will no longer consider their shipbreaking yards as dustbins, as places where they can put in punished their toxic waste. And we now will fight for an international regime that will allow continuation of shipbreaking activities in Asia without putting at risk the health of Indian workers and the health of the environment.
Chirac has ordered the ship to be examined to check claims that officials overstated the amount of asbestos removed before the ship left. And he's called for Europe, which doesn't have any yards big enough to tackle the Clemenceau, to expand its capacity for clearing toxic material. The president took personal control of the dossier yesterday, ahead of a visit to India on Sunday and Monday, during which he hopes to discuss cooperation on nuclear power and defence. Meanwhile, a Bangladeshi company today announced that it has bought the French ship Norway with a view to dismantling it. The Norway also contains asbestos. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
In Washington, a contentious bill that would have created a $140 billion trust fund for asbestos victims has failed in the Senate due to a procedural vote. Supporting senators say the bill is far from dead and could be revisited in coming weeks. The bill will now go back to the Judiciary Committee, where it was created. New York State has filed a lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency over its refusal to provide records on what ingredients of household and industrial products might contribute to air pollution. Rebecca Miles has the story.
The lawsuit filed yesterday by New York State on behalf of the Department of Environmental Conservation came after a two-year battle with EPA to obtain records about the chemical compounds in household products and paints. The suit claims the EPA has violated the Freedom of Information Act by failing to provide the information to state officials who needed the records to come up with a plan to comply with the Clean Air Act. According to the lawsuit, paint and household manufacturers claim information about potential pollutants are proprietary trade secrets. But records received by the state show that paint producers have paid to bypass certain federal regulations. New York's Attorney General, Elliot Spitzer, said about the lawsuit, "The EPA has no grounds on which to deny such a request and is entitled to this critical information to preserve public health. The Environmental Protection Agency was created in 1970 to protect human health and the environment." For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Rebecca Miles reporting from New York.
Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh has invited Kashmiri separatist leader Yasin Malik for talks on February 17th. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Accepting the invite for talks, the Jammu and Kashmir Liberation Front chairman Yasin Malik today said he and JKLF General Secretary Ghulam Rasool Eidi will meet with Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh on Friday. Malik is the second leader outside the separatist alliance, All Parties Hurriyat Conference, to be called for talks by the Indian Prime Minister. Malik, however, said he was going for consultations with the Indian Prime Minister and not for a dialogue. The JKLF leader criticized past talks between various Kashmiri separatists and New Delhi as photo ops rather than a sincere inclusion in the decision-making process. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Shahnawaz Khan.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Senator Russ Feingold of Wisconsin is blocking all progress on the Patriot Act, which is supposed to be taken up by the Senate today. Feingold is in staunch opposition to the act because he says it violates basic civil liberties. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
Democratic Senator Russ Feingold from Wisconsin was the only senator to oppose the USA Patriot Act when it was passed weeks after September 11, 2001. And now he is holding up the Patriot Act reauthorization bill.
But I will also continue to strongly oppose any reauthorization of the Patriot Act that does not protect the rights and freedoms of law-abiding Americans who have absolutely no connection whatsoever to terrorism. This deal does not meet that standard.
Senator Feingold is objecting to a compromise version of the bill. That compromise would pass the Republican-led House of Representatives, appease the White House, and possibly attract enough votes in the Senate.
Now, you might ask, in this newly announced deal on the Patriot Act, have any of these five problems been solved? The answer is simple, Mr. President. The answer is no. Not a single one. The White House applied immense pressure and pulled out its usual scare tactics and succeeded in somehow convincing people to accept a deal that makes only a tiny substantive improvement to a bill that was actually rejected in December.
But Republican Senator Arlen Specter from Pennsylvania and chair of the Judiciary Committee said the House made lots of concessions. He will support this compromised version.
Negotiations have provided some minor changes, which frankly are cosmetic only. But sometimes cosmetics will make a beauty out of a beast and provide enough cover for senators to change their votes.
The changes will add sunsets to several provisions, allowing Congress to revisit the issues in 4 years. Another compromise is that libraries will be excluded from receiving national security letters. Those letters inform a person, organization, or business that the government can obtain personal or financial records. And the last element of compromise is that those who receive these national security letters will be able to challenge their case in court after 1 year. Before, it was not at all. These changes aren't enough for Senator Feingold, so he will do everything in his power to block this bill, especially because substantive changes were not made to a part of the bill known as Section 215. Section 215 allows the government to obtain a court order through the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act for personal records. A desired change to this section wanted the government to meet strict requirements, most notably that the person in question has a direct connection to a known terrorist. Again, Senator Feingold.
The government should not have the kind of broad, intrusive powers in Section 215. Not this government, not any government. And the American people shouldn't have to live with a poorly drafted provision that clearly allows for the records of innocent Americans to be searched and just somehow hope that the government uses it with restraint.
There has to be adequate means of judicial review when the government goes and says we want to undertake surveillance. This is really what the heart of the 215 debate is about.
Mark Rodenberg is executive director at the Electronic Privacy Information Center. This lack of judicial review could violate the First Amendment because when a person is notified that their records are being obtained, they are automatically issued a gag order. The courts have no ability to review individual cases. It is unclear when or if Senator Feingold will withdraw his hold and allow the Senate to vote to pass the Patriot Act reauthorization. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
House Representative Charles Rangel has submitted a bill calling to reinstitute the military draft. Rangel says he is not optimistic that the bill will pass, but that he has submitted it to illustrate the sacrifice that low-income soldiers are making on the war's front lines.
I hope that for those who support the president's war policy, that they realize how unfair it is to see that we've lost 2,200 men and women, we have 16,000 to 20,000 maimed, hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead, and we don't have a shared sacrifice. It seems to me that if the president is putting the military option on the table with Iran, is straddling the swords for Syria and North Korea, that America, if they believe it's in our national security interests, then more people than those who come from poor communities should be asked to serve.
Rangel says that new military recruitment incentives are not appealing to patriotic beliefs, but instead to economic need.
They've increased the age now to 42. They've dropped the requirement that you need a high school diploma. And they've increased the bonuses to $40,000. I don't really think these type of incentives are attracting one's patriotic beliefs. I think that they're financial incentives, but a nation as great as ours should only go to war for patriotism and national defense.
Rangel submitted a similar bill last year, but it was never debated. He's urging the Republican-led Congress to allow debate on the bill this year. The Senate Committee on Homeland Security took up its 20th hearing today, grilling Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff about the federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina. Despite bipartisan criticism of the response, the department, which includes FEMA, is one of only two federal departments receiving an increase to its budget this year. Darby Hickey has more from D.C.
Chair of the Committee on Homeland Security, Senator Susan Collins, began the questioning today of Michael Chertoff, head of the Department of Homeland Security. The Republican senator from Maine built her questions on the testimony the committee has heard over the previous months pertaining to their investigation into the federal response to Hurricane Katrina. Citing the testimony by former FEMA Director Michael Brown last week, Senator Collins criticized the poor communications within the department during the aftermath of Katrina's landfall and came down hard on the role of Chertoff himself.
Your actions are puzzling to me because despite what you said in your opening statement earlier in the week, in contrast to later when you were clearly fully engaged, you did seem curiously disengaged to me.
Senator Collins also questioned Secretary Chertoff's decision to place Michael Brown as the top official dealing with the hurricane response efforts. Although he began his testimony by saying he took responsibility for all that happened regarding Hurricane Katrina, Chertoff claimed he did not know of the extent of damage to New Orleans until Tuesday after the storm.
So I was mindful of the issue of breaching because I knew that if we had a substantial breach, I don't mean a small breach, that would pose a second set of problems. I'm sure we'll get into the question of why I didn't hear about emails that came later that night, but I will tell you at least when I went to bed, it was my belief, and it was somewhat fortified by things I saw on TV, that actually the storm had not done it the worst that had been imagined. I think it actually moved a little bit to the east at the last minute.
This contradicts what Michael Brown testified, that he had informed federal officials Monday afternoon of levee breaches. After Secretary Chertoff's opening remarks, a man sitting directly behind the Homeland Security head disrupted the hearing.
Sir,
in the ground.
Sir, this is not a public hearing today.
This is not American.
FSRN spoke with Reverend Lennox Yearwood of Shreveport, Louisiana, about why he spoke out.
Because there are mothers and children who are being thrown out in the street, who are being evicted. And as we sit here and play the blame game, there are mothers who are now pushing shopping carts around the streets of Louisiana, around the streets of this country, and they just can't continue. And so just to have these answers, that can't continue. People need a right to return and need housing.
Senator Mark Dayton, Democrat of Minnesota, criticized the culture at FEMA, which he said was filled with industry insiders. Dayton called on Homeland Security Secretary Chertoff to hire more professionals who
aren't allowed then to leave office and turn around and become consultants for companies and that are making hundreds of millions of dollars off the misery of the people that are still suffering down there and not even performing on the contracts. I think you've got a monumental disaster, and I think FEMA is the disaster today. That's an even greater disaster than the disasters it's supposed to be addressing.
The House of Representatives released a report this afternoon about its own investigations into the Hurricane Katrina response, criticizing every level of government from the president to the mayor of New Orleans. Democrats did not participate in that process and are calling for an independent commission to conduct an inquiry such as the 9/11 review. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
While there is no way to determine exact numbers, both documented and undocumented Latino immigrants are heading to New Orleans for work. Although reports have highlighted abhorrent work conditions and lack of pay, new developments indicate some improvements in both working and living conditions, largely due to a budding cooperative relationship with smaller contractors. FSRN's Rachel Clark has more.
Months after Katrina has devastated New Orleans, many residents are rebuilding. Latino immigrants, like Manuel Herrera Delgado, have come to the Gulf Coast region, not only seeking work, but also the opportunity to lend a helping hand.
We saw on the news that they needed help here, so we came to lend a hand to those that needed it.
Manuel recalls not being paid by his first employer upon arriving at the Big Easy. Since that time, he has found both fair wages and housing from a small Georgia-based business.
At first, we came with a boss that had us working with him for a week, but he didn't pay us. Well, now they are paying us $12 an hour. Over there in South Carolina, they were promising us $10, but usually paid us half as much.
A similarly negative initial work experience was also had by Jose Gonzalez. But, says Gonzalez, Louisiana is not unique in this regard.
In the beginning, yeah, there were some contractors that didn't pay, but the person who we are working for now pays well. But this happens everywhere, not just here. I was working in Florida before, and in Florida, I was not paid for work I had done. There are always going to be one or two.
According to Gonzalez, what is different about working in the Big Easy is his employer's focus on safety measures.
The Army, the military gave us training about safety more than anything else, and the company too. They gave us a lot of training focusing on safety. That's why we use the protective goggles and masks. They gave us vaccines and shots to protect us against everything.
While less than 2% of contracts awarded by FEMA initially went to minority-owned companies, many more are operating in the city than what these official government statistics imply. They are able to do so by soliciting contracts directly with homeowners themselves. So how is it that small minority-owned businesses can treat workers well and compete with larger corporations? Isabel Davis, owner and laborer with Houston-based Davis Roofing and Gutting Company, conveyed it as a simple desire to help and an absence of greed.
And help out the people, too, from, you know, Katrina and stuff, so they won't have so much expenses out of their pocket. But, like I say, a lot of the companies are gouging their prices right now. They're really, I mean, it's ridiculous. So what we're trying to do is help out them, and I'm trying to help out the people from the other countries too. So, you know, everybody's trying to get along.
The partnership between businesses like Davis's and Latino immigrant laborers will continue to take pride in their role to rebuild New Orleans. As laborer Jose Gonzalez shared, it will take everyone working together to bring the city back.
I think this situation needs everybody to help. Latino immigrants, Americans, everybody that can.
Reporting from New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Rachel Clark, Free Speech Radio News.
Homeless movements are growing in Brazil, largely due to the housing crisis. Groups take over empty buildings and land and condemn the lack of housing programs. The Downtown Homeless Movement, or MSTC, of Sao Paulo has organized mass demonstrations to preserve the largest high-rise building occupation in Latin America, called Prestes Maia. FSRN's Natalia Viana has the story.
Homeless movements are growing fast in big Brazilian cities. Brazil has more than 6 million people living in bad conditions, but only a handful of government programs destined to those who earn less than 3 minimum wages per month, about $450. In São Paulo, the problem is even bigger. There is an estimated 2 million people, mostly immigrants, living in the shanty towns of the city outskirts. Another 600,000 people live in the slums and 15,000 live in the streets. The big irony is that there are many empty buildings waiting for real estate value to grow. There are about 200 buildings completely empty only in the city center. Activists are reclaiming abandoned buildings for the unemployed and low-income workers. Homeless Wanda Araújo explains why.
The downtown area has health centers, hospitals, trains, buses, schools, everything that is needed.
As a strategy to demand habitation programs, the homeless movements invade empty buildings and organize a community life with their own coordination, wrote a system for cleaning and securing. Prestes Maia is the biggest vertical occupation in South America. For over 3 years, 468 families, or over 1,500 people, have lived in the 22-storied building. At first glance, it resembles a chaotic multi-storied shantytown. The 12-foot by 12-foot rooms were built by the homeless using cardboard and pieces of wood. The windows are broken, the walls are covered with graffiti, and improvised electric lines are strung along the ceiling. But the place is full of life, with children playing on the stairs and elderly people talking in the corridors. The key to it all is organization. Residents contribute with $10 a month to the upkeep of the building, and a rota system exists for cleaning each floor. João Marina Fonseca, a leader of MSTC, Homeless Movement of São Paulo Center, explained the rules.
No drugs are allowed in here. Also, no robbery. When a husband threatens his wife, we interfere. We don't allow people to fight in here.
Every day in the basement of the building, the inhabitants have workshops of arts and crafts, recycling and electricity. They can also attend a library with more than 3,500 books donated by collaborators of the movement. Wanda Araújo is often seen at the library. She's proud to say she has read over 1,000 books in her life, and says she desires to write a book about the occupation so that the governors would see they are workers and not criminals.
We have a history here. We transformed a place that had been abandoned for over a decade into a place fit for living. It's not a palace, but it's our home. People live here and they have to understand this.
The mayor José Serra has an aggressive project of rehabilitation of the city center, and due to it, the government ceased the negotiations with the homeless movements. Last year, 4 occupations were emptied by the police. All of them remain empty today. Councilman Paulo Teixeira says the government is being neglectful to the homeless.
O que aconteceu com esse governo? Não é conosco.
What happens with this government? They say it's not our problem. They think the city center is for the middle class. They do not know that Sao Paulo Center is the most socially diverse place in the city.
The local police has given the deadline of February 15 for the families of Prestes Maia. If not, they will be expelled. The leaders of MSTC have tried to get an interview with the government with no luck. Until now, there is no proposal for a place to set the families. The perspective is that these 1,500 people will be thrown in the streets. But some inhabitants, like Wanda Lima, assure they won't give up without fighting.
We are surely going to protest by camping on the street.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Natalia Viana in São Paulo, Brazil.
As South Africa gears up for next month's municipal elections, organized shack dwellers have been mobilizing to protest the lack of service deliveries in their communities. FSRN's Naim Gina has more.
Since the beginning of the year, shack dwellers have held protests around South Africa. The number will increase dramatically as the country gets closer to municipal elections on March 1st. Some actions turned violent, with police being the main culprits. Last year, according to South Africa's Minister of Police, there were almost 900 illegal protests around the country, mainly focused on the lack of delivery of services, electricity, water, sanitation and housing. In the midst of these protests, South Africa saw the emergence of an organization representing shack dwellers called Abahlali Basemjondolo. Sbu Zikode, one of the leaders of the movement, says it began in Durban to give voice to shack dwellers.
There was a real need for us to really begin to say, this is who we are, this is where we are, this is what we want, and this is our pain and our suffering. And we have realized and discovered that nobody is prepared to voice our issues and address our issues. Now it is clear that the voices of the Shakwellers are being heard and are getting louder and louder every day, which is the first time in the history of South Africa finding the poor of the poorest taking their own issues.
According to Housing Minister Lindiwe Sisulu, the number of shack dwellings in South Africa rose from 1.45 million in 1996, just after South Africa's first democratic election, to 2.14 million in 2003, almost 270 shacks per day. Meaning shack dwellers, Abahlali Basem Jondolo is the largest organization to rise out of the squatter camps, the sprawling informal settlements characterized by poverty, filth and disease. Again, Sibuzi Kode.
8,000 people sharing three toilets is that human? I mean, it's so inhuman. Can you imagine?
The voices are being articulated in an angry, passionate, and sometimes almost insurrectionist way, says Richard Pithouse, researcher at Durban Center for Civil Society.
There's been this incredible upsurge in protests in the last year. 881 illegal protests and over 5,000 legal protests. Absolutely unprecedented in the post-apartheid era. Many of these have been conducted in a sort of semi-insurrectionist manner. People are really prepared to confront state power.
Shack dwellers' protests are taking place all over the country. Organizing is happening at the local level to express the frustration of South Africa's poorest. In general, the repression from the police has been brutal and occurs in multiple ways.
Protests have been illegally and unconstitutionally banned, and then also protesters have often been assaulted in ways that are in direct violation of the law. There's been no warning given to disperse. People have been brutally attacked, and you know, in some cases live ammunition has been used. And then there's been a sort of ongoing intelligence operation, and there's been a lot of intimidation. People have been called in and interrogated, threatened.
One tactic used by protesters has been occupying the main highways. The protests and their scale is unsurprising, says University of KwaZulu-Natal academic Raj Patel.
For the 1.3 million people who live in the shacks, in what are called the informal settlements, they've been waiting for a very long time. And so, to an extent, it's unsurprising that there have been over 5,000 protests last year by people demanding services from the government, but also demanding housing. And the reason for that is that they're tired of waiting.
Surprisingly, as Patel emphasizes, many protesters are members of South Africa's ruling party, the African National Congress.
As one resident of a settlement in Durban put it, he said, we are the ANC, and what we're going to do is wait until 2009 when an appropriate ANC candidate is put before us. They don't want to vote for anyone else. They want to vote for the ANC for which they fought in the 1980s, because people still feel very loyal to the ANC.
Pithouse agrees.
The message that the government should be getting is quite clear, that their most loyal supporters feel deeply betrayed and are willing to risk arrest and assault from the police.
The result for this disillusionment will be seen on March 1st, when South Africans vote in municipal elections. Many South Africans say they will not vote because they have received no benefit from South African democracy. Zikode is emphatic.
No house, no land, no vote. Simple means no delivery, no vote. In as far as the local government election is concerned, we are actually saying we are not going to vote.
It is a cry around the country going out from shack dwellers who feel they now have some power to have their voices heard. And it is a voice that will be very loud come March 1st.
I don't want to vote for the councillor. I'm waiting for a house, but there's no house. I don't know what I must do.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Naeem Gina in Johannesburg.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News, an independent, worker-run collective produced out of Pacifica stations KPFA in Berkeley and KPFK in Los Angeles. Our newscast is produced by Simba Russo and Monica Lopez. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team includes Jade Paget-Seekins and Eric Klein. Our website is www.fsrn.org. You can also write to us at comments@fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. Thanks for listening.